Welcome to the Lesbian Book Club with Claire Lydon. Please enjoy the podcast from My Lesbian Radio.
Hello and welcome to episode 68 of the Lesbian Book Club. This month we have an interview with UK author Kirsty Eyre, and you're not going to want to miss it. It's coming up very shortly, but first let's see what's hot in the UK and US Amazon lesbian fiction charts, as well as finding out what's going on in the world of lesfic and what's going on in the world of me. First up in the Amazon charts, topping the charts as I record this on March the 22nd, is Nicole Pyland with her new book, Love Forged. Now, Nicole is a much-loved lesbian romance author, quite often tops the charts. This one is about Tate Antonio, who's been without her father for 13 years. She's given up on hearing about him when a strange letter arrives in her mailbox that she shares with her best friend since birth, Flynn McIntyre. Good character names here, aren't they? Very good. So we've got Tate and Flynn, and the two have shared all of life's milestones. Going to university, going to medical school, getting married. Clearly they're not married anymore, I'm guessing, because they're living together. And it seems that Flynn's dream has changed, and she wonders if Tate realises that she's in love with her. Flynn then accompanies Tate on a road trip of sorts through the summer to find her father. So will Tate find her father, and will the two of them find love together? I'm guessing the answer might be yes, but this one, as I said, is by Nicole Pyland, and she is much loved by the lesbian fiction, lesbian romance reading public. Also doing well in the charts is Elodie by Emma Nichols. Now, Emma had a breakout hit a few summers back with Remember Me and Finding You. Might have been the other way around, but those two. And also with more recently with Cosa Nostra and Cosa Nostra 2. Now, this latest one, Elodie, is about a woman called Elodie Marchland who has it all, money, power and women. She also owns a prestigious winery in France. So it's set in France in a vineyard. I love it. Emma Nichols does really know how to drop a character in a bit of a different circumstance and describe it and have you there immediately. She likes to travel the world with her fiction, which is another thing I love about her stuff. So we go back to Elodie, who's built a perfect life and is happy sharing it with no one. When a travelling stranger drops into her world, she's forced to reassess everything she knows. That travelling stranger is Kay Skies. She's wandering the world trying to put down new roots after escaping a controlling and abusive marriage. When she volunteers to pick grapes at the vineyard, Kay meets charming and beautiful and enigmatic Elodie. What begins as an instant and powerful sexual attraction soon becomes much more, and both women try to fight it for different reasons. Can they overcome their initial wobbles to find true love? You have to read the book and find out. Well, the cover, I suspect, is selling it a little bit more than usual as well, because it has a slightly naked lady in a pool or in some kind of water. Also doing well in the lesbian romance charts is the latest one from the co-writing duo TB Markinson and Miranda McLeod, and this one is called The Love Project. It concerns two women, strangely enough. Joni Fisher is facing economic ruin. She runs a once successful advice column called Help Me Henrietta, but it's on the brink of cancellation. Joni's last-ditch effort to save her job and preserve her mother's legacy is The Love Project, a web series she's developing to bring the Help Me Henrietta franchise a second life. All she needs is a willing star. Hope Alvarez dreams of falling in love, but physical attraction is a foreign language to her. She's kind of given up, frankly. But can her favourite advice columnist Henrietta save her from a lonely future? As the two join together for the web series, fans swoon for unlucky hope, and they're not the only ones. But Joni's been down that road before, vowing never to fall for a straight woman. But is Hope a straight woman? Is Joni reading it all wrong? Can love save the day? And as I said, TB Markinson and Miranda McLeod have penned quite a few novels, and they seem to have a lot of fun doing so, and readers seem to love them doing it too. Also doing well in the lesbian fiction chart is the latest one from Lees Gold. This one is called Blue. Now, a little bit like Emma Nichols, Lees Gold does like to travel the world with her fiction, and that's something I do admire. This one concerns Celia Krugener, who visits her Uncle Dieter's castle in Switzerland. When was the last time we had a lesbian romance in Switzerland? So hurrah for Lees and her globe-trotting ways. She visits her uncle's castle in a castle too, a Swiss castle. Lees Gold wins the destination lottery for this month's lesbian fiction. So we got Celia. She's away to her uncle's castle in Switzerland for his annual summer ball, and she's going to meet up with Erin, who she shared an unforgettable dance with the year before. Erin is a super yacht designer and avid traveller. Fantastic. And she sailed from Bermuda to be at the ball. After the ball, her uncle Dieter invites Erin and Celia and his love interest Andy to join him on a yacht for what's going to be his last voyage, and they all embark on a life-altering journey together. But with secrets between them, can love prevail? This one sounds very interesting. I love the cover. And yes, Lees Gold is a surefire banker for a great story and all the emotions, all the feels. So that's US charts. The UK charts are looking very similar to how they did last month. Claire Chambers' Small Pleasures is still at the top. I read this. It's heartbreaking, actually, this one. It is listed in lesbian fiction. It does have a side lesbian relationship in it, so it's not one of those ones that's just been put in the wrong category, so hurrah for that. I love this book. It was set in the 1950s UK. It's a great slice of historical fiction, but as I said, nobody really has that much pleasure in the book. It is not a rom-com, but it's beautifully written. It's a little heartbreaking, so be warned if you read it, but I would say it's well worth reading. Also doing well is Insatiable by Daisy Buchanan, which seems to be about a woman called Violet who stumbles into sex parties and threesomes. So be warned, there are men in this book as well, but I like the cover. It is somebody ripping open an orange, and it's called, and the tagline is, A Love Story for Greedy Girls. And that's the chart roundup for March 2021. Yikes again. Double yikes, in fact. I mean, I was just saying this on the other podcast that I do with TB Markinson, Lesbians Who Write, that January seemed to go on like forever, didn't it? Like, I'm normally a fan of January, but this January was pretty long. And then February sort of meandered by, and now March has sped by. It's going to be Christmas soon, so I hope you've all done your Christmas shopping. Ha ha ha. What's going on in the world of Lesfic, and what's going on in the world of me? Well, Lesfic Land is carrying on as usual. I think all the conferences that would normally be in person are staying online for this year, which I think is the right decision. I know London Book Fair is still umming and ahhing about whether to host one in person in June or July, but I think they're going to end up being online as well, because the world is just not there just yet, is it? Our vaccination program here in the UK is doing pretty well, so that's a positive thing to report around the coronavirus in the UK, which we haven't had a lot of positivity to report, let's face it. But you know, until the rest of the world has a good vaccination program in place as well, which is not going well around Europe, all around some parts of Africa and all over the world, so you know, until everybody's got a vaccination program, I think that all the conferences will stay online, and that is fine. So we have GCLS is the Golden Crown Literary Society events. That is online this year, as is Lambda Literary. For the awards, Lambda Literary has announced all the categories for its awards, and there are a host of them. Gay fiction, lesbian fiction, transgender fiction, bisexual fiction, and poetry for all those categories, and a host of others. But the lesbian fiction category sees Beastery by Kaiming Chang, Butter Honey Pig Bread by Francesca Ekuyasi, Exile Music by Jennifer Style, Fibra Tropical by Julie Delgado, and Pizza Girl by Jean Kyung. So well done to all those five for getting through to the final of it all. And in lesbian romance, there are some very familiar names up for the gong. They include Finding Jessica Lambert by Claire Ashton, Nottingham by Anna Burke, One More Chance by Ali Valley, Written in the Stars by Alexandra Belfleur, and Wrong Number, Right Woman by Jay. So good luck to all of those, and I believe that the final is on June the 1st, and you can go to that virtually. So if that is something you're interested in, go to lambdaliterary.org and click on awards. As for the Golden Crown Literary Society, they haven't announced all the finalists for their award categories, of which, again, there are quite a few. The only one they have announced so far is the Anne Bannum Popular Choice, and there are 8 books dueling and duking it out for that, including the likes. Authors included in it are, well, similar to the Lambda Literary, actually. Claire Ashton and Anna Burke are there, Lee Winter, E.J. Noyes, Jay, Penny Micklebury, Cheryl A. Head and Lynn Ames. So well done to all those and good luck. And I think, I'm not sure when that is actually, but I know the conference used to be in July, so I imagine it's going to be there. And I will let you know the results once they're all announced. So that's it for the world of Lesvic. Now we're going to sing what's going on in the world of me. Well, I am currently working on London Romance Book 8, which is entitled Big London Dreams. Now this one is Book 8, as I said, in the London Romance series. It's the story of Eunice and Joan, who were the kind of secondary love story in Book 7, Hot London Nights. This one is a little different from the others. I'm going back to the 1950s, and I'm showcasing Eunice and Joan's ill-fated love story from the 1950s. In Book 7, they were shown coming back together again 60 years later, so it is the ultimate second chance romance. Second chance romance, if you don't know, is my absolute favourite trope in romance. So I know there was a big sort of quiz on what's your favourite trope on Twitter the other day, and I think I saw it somewhere else as well. And I'm shocked actually that second chance romances don't score very highly. What's everyone thinking? Apparently everyone loves an ice queen, which is really bad for me because I'm really bad at writing ice queens. In my book, everyone just, you know, they like a laugh and they make a joke and diffuse any conflict that they might have at the beginning. So I really need to work on my two characters hating each other to start with and then coming around, don't I? Because it seems like everyone loves an ice queen, whereas me, I just love things that go wrong and then they get a second chance later down the line. Now, normally my second chances later down the line are maybe sort of, I think I've done twice in a lifetime. That was about 20 years down the line. And You're My Kind, that was 10 years down the line. But this one that I'm writing now, Big London Dreams, that's right. There's too many Londons in all my titles, aren't there? Big London Dreams, 60 years down the line. So, wow, it trumps all my second chance romance that I've done before. It's like, I see your 10 years, hold my beer. So, but I'm really enjoying writing it, but and I've just finished the first draft, so that's exciting. Now, it is up for pre-order. I may have to move this pre-order out a bit because I've had some stuff happen in life that I've had to deal with, so I will probably have to move this pre-order out, but do carry on pre-ordering it because it'll only be a few weeks with luck, so maybe a month, maybe 6 weeks. I am in the midst of writing it, just about to start on draft 2, so that's very exciting. I've got the bones of it down, I just need to add in all the 1950s details. So I have been reading 1950s fiction, I've got some 1950s books, I've been looking at 1950s photos of London, so it's really interesting actually just finding out all that sort of stuff, and finding out that the tubes didn't used to have those electronic boards in the 1950s, so you just had to wait till one came. It's I remember my frustration going to New York the first time, because they haven't got any electronic boards there. Still, in 2021, my mind was blown. So I'm enjoying writing that and looking forward to getting it done. And after that, I'm not sure really what I'm going to be writing, but I have got a couple of options. I've got like 4 different books that I want to write up on my board above my desk. So I've got to have a think about that and see where I'm going sort of once this one is out, which will probably take us up to halfway through the year. Other than that, in February as well, since we last spoke, I did do an online evening with Claire Lydon, sort of Q&A in association with Stockport Library, which was a really fantastic evening, actually. And I was so thrilled. So if you did come along, thank you, because there were 55 people turned up, which astounded me. And it was so well done by the lovely librarians of Stockport Library. Really well organised, very professionally done. And they sent me chocolate to say thank you. Chocolate in the shape of boobs. So I don't know what more I want from life now. Not much really, but it was really enjoyable evening, and I had a very sore throat the next day because I chatted for like an hour and a half. I mean, I like to chat, but that was a lot of chat, not gonna lie. But I really love doing it, so it has made me think maybe I might do a few more of those, because they're great things to do, and especially when everybody's still at home. And even if lockdown, we can see the roadmap out of it in the UK, but in other parts of the world, they're not doing so well. So. And even if we are unlocked, I think more things will be online in the new world, in the new normal. So yeah, expect maybe for me to do my own little evening in the coming months. All right, well, let's get on now to the lovely interview with the lovely Kirsty Eyre. Cowgirl was my book of 2020. So if you haven't read it, do rush and read it, but also do listen to this interview because she's fabulous. Joining me today is Kirsty Eyre. Kirsty grew up in South Yorkshire, idolising comedy writers like Sue Townsend. She studied languages at Nottingham Trent University, which led her to a love for theatre and writing and directing several comedy stage plays. Her first novel, Cowgirl, won the inaugural Comedy Women in Print and a publishing contract with HarperCollins. It's also since been shortlisted for the Romantic Novelists Association's 2021 Debut Award. Whoop whoop! Kirsty lives in southeast London with her partner and two kids and loves tea, friendship, but hates her big toes. So, Kirsty, welcome to the podcast. What's up with your big toes?
Oh, thank you for having me. They're quite manly. I'd say they're quite, you know, I've got awkward big toes, and they also have a little smattering of hair on them.
Right.
So, yeah, when I wear flip-flops, they're more flop than they are flip. Not much on them at all.
I'd say embrace them. Embrace it and, you know, give...
I should show you, but I think that might be a bit too much on the obsession.
comb that little bit of hair on your big toe. Give it some love. So how are you doing in lockdown? How's it been?
Crazy, hasn't it? I mean, I'm in one of those positions where I've got young primary age children, so I'm in the homeschooling type zone at the moment, and feel like I've got a bit of PTSD going on. It's been really tough. I've still got my 3-day a week day job, which pays the bills, so I'm not a full-time writer yet, and I am struggling to find the time to write.
I can totally imagine that would be quite difficult, a day job and a couple of kids and your writing, but you're doing it all, so well done you.
Puppy. We got a puppy 3 weeks ago.
Oh, what kind of puppy did you get?
A schnoodle.
A schnoodle. I haven't heard of a schnoodle.
I just like saying the word schnoodle. She's half miniature schnauzer and half miniature poodle. She's very cute.
Right.
But yeah, I just thought rein the pain a bit more.
Yes. Well. You're really doing lockdown.
Yeah. I am. I'm a statistic.
So tell me a little bit about where you're sitting right now. What can you see?
I'm sitting in the spare room at the back of my house, which is in Hither Green in southeast London. It's raining, and my son was playing football in the garden yesterday and booted the football through a glass panel in the shed. So I'm looking at broken glass.
Real life is going on around you, inspiring you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Excellent. So tell me a bit about your writing journey, Kirsty. We touched on it in the intro, but tell me a bit about it and how you got started.
Yeah, so I was late to the party on writing, I think, really. And it wasn't until I was 30 that I really got stuck into writing. And it started when I was helping a friend write a stage play. And at that time, it was a pantomime commissioned by Eurostar in London. And each year, they used to put on these pantomimes in a small art house theatre in Waterloo. And I helped him write the script and then went on to become the script writer for pantomimes. And then it led to me writing stage plays, and they'd always be comedy. And then I kind of hit the Fringe circuit and went up to Edinburgh Fringe Festival a few times and really, really enjoyed it. I absolutely loved writing stage plays. But then I found that once I'd had children, I was a bit out of the game for rehearsals in terms of evening and weekend performances, you know, with actors. So I had to write something that I could do around the clock and that didn't require actors or performing. So yeah, I turned my hand to a book, and I make it sound really easy, and it really wasn't. And it, as you know, it took me years. But yeah, finally got there with Cowgirl.
And let's talk about Cowgirl, because honestly, it was my book of 2020. So you win the prize from me as well.
Thank you.
No, I absolutely loved it. It's a corking British rom-com, a roller coaster ride stamped through with humour and heart. And it's about Billy's struggle to find her place in the world and help her family and find the right woman. So tell me and the listeners about writing it and how you birthed the idea.
Yeah, so the idea formed in my subconscious probably quite a few years ago now. And one of my friends became my muse for Billy's voice, which, to be honest, over time morphed more into my own. Ironically, you'd think that you'd start with your own and morph into somebody else's, but it was more that way. And I'm from that area of the world. I'm from the South Yorkshire, Derbyshire border. And my parents retired to a place just down the road from Baslow, which is cited in the book, which is where this dairy farm is, which became my muse. And you can walk through it, public footpath through the middle, and just the sights, the sounds, and particularly the smells, I just found it so like rich pickings for writing. That became my muse as a character as much as Billy did. And so I then did quite a lot of research about dairy farming and understood that there was a massive plight around it, particularly as a lot of people are turning to veganism and talking about cow farts ruining the ozone and all that good stuff. And I just felt that there's a battle to be had. So that's really where the idea came about. But it changed over time. When I first started out, I used to pitch it as an LGBT Bridget Jones's Diary. And as you know, the script was in diary format right at the beginning. And then I was advised to change that, and was told that not everybody reads journals or writes journals these days, and that I should steer away from that and go back to straight narrative, which is what I ended up doing. So I think I rewrote the book about three times, all in all.
The end result was amazing. And like you say, the novel's set in the countryside, but it's also got one foot, hasn't it, in the glamorous, absolutely, world of London lesbians. But you do spend a lot of time in the country with Billy as she goes back to help her dad and gran out on her dairy farm. I must tell you as well, because I absolutely loved Billy. She's a great character, very human, very flawed, and she'll have you shouting at her sometimes. I must tell you as well that I asked my readers on my newsletter a couple of weeks ago who they'd like to take out for a date, any character that they'd read in a book, and one person did choose Billy. So if things go wrong with the woman she ends up with, I'm not going to give the end away, she's got somebody else in the wings, okay?
That's great. Yeah. She'll be really happy to know that. As long as they don't mind a pair of wellies.
Yeah. So did you, I know you said that you had a friend who you based her Billy on, but did she evolve through the writing process?
Yeah, so what's quite funny is, so I think I went out to write comedy, and maybe it was almost just not enough light and shade with it all, and played too much for the laughs at the beginning. And then as it went through the editing process and I was told to draw on Billy's vulnerabilities more and get more out of her interiority, I'd say my own voice creeped in a bit more. Because I think, you know, she is a mixture, really, of self-awareness, but also self-doubt. There's a lot of self-doubt in there. And I think all of us do doubt ourselves at times, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
And probably even your best mate that you hang out with, you can't understand her self-doubt like she can. So I feel like it probably ended up with a bit more of my heart in it by the end.
I think every character you write always has a bit of you in it, right?
Yeah, definitely.
And have you fallen in love with cows? Did you fall in love with cows during this process? Because I think I did, reading the book.
I absolutely love cows. So I didn't grow up on a dairy farm, but my stepdad did, and a friend of mine did as well. I just love all their characters. They are fascinating creatures, and it's easy to just, you know, walk through a field or past a field of cows thinking they're all the same, and they are not. There's complex relationships amongst the herd, and I just found them compelling to write about, particularly after I'd researched quite a lot about them in terms of milking, hoof care. There was so much stuff that ended up in the script that then got taken out as well, so I feel like I really did my homework.
I will tell you that I'm quite afraid of cows. So when I walk through a field of cows, I sort of gingerly walk around the edge. But so to get me to fall in love with cows and think, oh, I love the cows, you did a good job.
Oh, I think a lot of people are frightened of cows because when you go into a field of cows, they all look like they're staring at you. They all stop dead in their tracks and stare at you. But really, that's their fight or flight response. So they're thinking, you know, because they are prey at the end of the day rather than predators. And they're thinking, do I have to bolt from this wild woman in my field?
I might have a wild look in my eyes when I go through a field of cows, that's for sure. So as well as being a book that will make you fall in love with cows, it's also a novel about family ties and touches on the wonderful small moments that glue families together, which I love and I try to include in my books too. The dad and the gran were fabulous characters. So did you enjoy writing all the family bits as well?
I love writing the family bits. The grandma in Cowgirl is based on my own grandma. So I found her voice came to me thick and fast. And my grandma was an ardent Yorkshire woman that was no nonsense. And what are you doing with all that muck on your face if you wore makeup? She was that kind of person. And I also remember as a teenager, it was high fashion at that moment to have crop tops. And she'd just look at me and just say something like, ran out of material, did they? No makeup top. You know, those kind of things, or some of it quite off. If you were in a cafe in her loud voice, you'd be a bit cringing under the table, but she was great, Grandma was.
Yeah.
And I really, really enjoyed writing Grandma's dialogue.
Yeah, it was terrific. I think those are some of the bits that I do really remember as well. And your grandma sounds a bit like my mum. My mum still sort of, if you walk in with ripped jeans, she'd be like, Did they not have enough material now? So you also touch on homophobia and misogyny, which Billy experiences, which are two ever-presents in the world for every queer woman on the planet, unfortunately. But you didn't shy away from it, which I liked. It made the book real. So was that important for you to include as well?
I think it's really, really important because it isolated her even more from the community that she'd gone to. So she went from being a city girl to a country lass. And that transition in itself is hard enough as it is, you know, to be out in Soho, out in like lesbian clubs, dancing and grieving one day, and then in a field of cowpats the next day, talking to villagers. And she, at this point, obviously thinks that she's the only gay in the village, as it were. And I just feel like her battle is so much stronger as a result of the misogyny and homophobia and the obstacles that she has to cross. So it's hard enough as it is being a woman in dairy farming, but to be a lesbian woman in dairy farming, it kind of upped the ante and it made the battle even more important, I think. Mm. So I found that the victory at the end was even sweeter.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it did come across that way. Readers will want to punch the air. So, as we said, this one did win the Funny Women Imprint Award in 2019, which makes it officially funny. You are officially funny. You've got an award for it. And
no pressure.
No. And as you said, you did set out to write a funny book at the beginning, but then it sort of ebbed and flowed as you went through. In the end, how pleased were you with the end product? Because quite often when you write a book, you have something in your head. It's very difficult to transfer it to the page. Are you happy with the romantic comedy it came out as?
Yeah, I am happy. I feel privileged to have gone through the editing process. And I think it's come out stronger as a result. And I think it's developed me more as a writer that way as well. I think I probably relied heavily in the earlier drafts on the comedy, because I was used to writing stage plays, it was probably more dialogue heavy. And if I'm honest, I was a bit nervous about writing so much description and interiority. I didn't feel that was my strength at all. And then I just had to up my game and step up and write those bits that I was trying to shy away from when I originally had it in a diary format. Mm-hmm. I just thought, if I write it as a diary, I can just say, oh, Claire and Kirsty were talking about blah, 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 and then slip into kind of note form. Like went to the shops, you know, and then not have to write a descriptive paragraph about the block of shops that I was visiting. But yeah, there was no shortcut really when it came round to it.
No, but I think when I'm writing, I quite often do write the dialogue first anyway, and then go back and fill in all the bits later to give it a bit more descriptive oomph. So you can still do that. As you were saying about, you know, you brought a bit more light and shade into it. So is there a trick to getting the balance right between laughs and emotion, do you think?
I'm sure there is. I don't know whether I've mastered it or not, to be quite honest. I think everyone's opinion is different as well. And what I'd say about humour is it's a tricky business, isn't it? Because what makes one person laugh won't make another person laugh, or might make them cringe. And it is a real balancing act. I mean, you can have witty dialogue, you can have slapstick humour in cow costumes, for example, or it's just, you can have just that edge of humour as you're telling a narrative. But all of that has got to balance out. And I just think it would be quite boring if you went on a non-stop journey of gags all the way. But yeah, I think it is tricky. I don't know whether there is any formula to mastering it. Maybe there is a formula somewhere that says you should have an X amount of laughs on a page. I don't know. But I think you have to go with your gut and then be told by an editor that your gut wasn't quite right.
I know I've been told before by editors in a couple of books that there's a lot of laughs in this book, Claire. Now you need a bit more substance. So, yeah, maybe it is just a balancing act that you have to come to in your own time.
Yeah.
So, and the book, as you said, is also up for an RNA Debut Romantic Novel Award for 2021. I think that's in March, right?
March the 8th.
March the 8th.
And so, the reason it is ingrained in my head is less about the actual RNA winners event, and it's more about the fact that the schools are supposed to open up on Monday the 8th of March in the UK and my children will hopefully, fingers crossed, go back to school and I'll be able to have a bath with the door open, or I don't know, have the luxury of washing my hair without being interrupted or something. But yeah the 8th of March.
Yeah. So, well, good luck with that. This interview is going to come out in March. I'm not exactly sure when, so it may or may not be out by the time you win. Let's be positive.
I practice my face, my losing face, you know, when they announce, because it's all on Zoom, and yeah, apparently we're going to a breakout room, because I had to have a tech check done on it.
Okay.
And so one of the ladies said, what happens, like, so the winner apparently goes into big screen, and then the losers, as it were, have to fade you out. So I don't know whether they have to just kind of drop you off the Zoom call and just delete you one by one. But I've practiced my face, like my little clap up in the air so that they can see my hands, like not on the table, and like a smile of glee for the winner and delete.
It's good that you practiced it, yeah. And you should have a glass of champagne as well, cheers them.
Oh yes, I should, shouldn't I? But then it might look as if I bought it for myself in case I think I'm the winner. That could be quite cringe.
Oh, it's a shame it's all being done on Zoom, isn't it? But never mind. And one other thing I wanted to ask was, you've got obviously a background writing plays, so how helpful was that when you were writing the novel? I know you said that there was still a learning curve, but were some skills transferable?
In terms of crossover between stage plays and novels, I'd say that the dialogue obviously stands you in really good stead, because a stage play would carry an enormous amount of dialogue, and so that's going to carry your lion's share into the novel as well. But I would say, as I mentioned before, I felt quite awkward around writing reams of description, because obviously my stage directions would normally get me through that, and I wouldn't have to really describe the door that the actor had just come through. And it would be more told as the story told as well through the actors, so I wouldn't have to write any interiority either. That would be for the actor to portray. But just in terms of formula, when I'm writing my novels now, I love the way I say novels, like I've written 50 million like you have, Claire, but you know, when I'm writing them, though, I do like to stick to that three-act format. So I find that structure really helps. And in terms of structure, it really helps having stage plays to guide you, and also just see you through the word count, because it is intimidating at the beginning, isn't it, writing a full-sized novel, you know, 90,000 words, and you've got to go the distance. And it's nice to just be able to break it up into like the setup, the playing it out, and then the resolution. And I think that a stage play holds you accountable to that.
Yeah, I know that a lot of writers do have a look at, like, Robert McKee's story and stuff like that, and a lot of people do use sort of stage screenwriting principles to write novels, because they get to the heart of the action, don't they?
Yeah.
So, and when I looked into publishing back in 2013, I was told by a fair few agents that no mainstream publishing house would publish a lesbian romance or rom-com. But times have changed, And now the mainstream is waking up to the fact there is a lesbian fiction market out there. Your book, there's Kate Davis's book in at the deep end. What's the other one? Something to Talk About by Meryl Wilsner. There's been quite a few sort of mainstream publishers publishing lesbian fiction. So clearly they're waking up to that fact. So are you going to write any more, or are you going to go in a different direction?
I'd say for each book, it really depends where the story takes me, to be quite honest. And it'll be more, I don't know about you, but stories come to me in weird ways. I could be walking through the woods and it might just trigger a scene. It's not normally, I start off with a scene and it builds out from there. So I just say it depends where stories take me. Yeah, and the project that I'm involved with at the moment is writing two books with male and female leads, both romantic comedies and both set in Mediterranean settings. Set in settings, can I say that?
Yes, you work with words, you can say what you like. So what I'm hearing, male-female romances set in Mediterranean settings. I love that, so I've repeated it. I'm hearing Shirley Valentine for the 2020s. Is that what you're doing?
It's so funny because I've pitched it as that in my log line.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Modern day Shirley Valentine. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm all up for that. Someone was watching that on Twitter the other day. It wasn't you, was it?
Yeah, it was me that did a shout out.
Oh, it was you. There you go.
Yeah, because obviously it's quite an old film now. It was in the 80s, wasn't it?
Mm.
And it was still brilliant when you watch it. There's particularly her performance as well, that piece to the camera. You know, she chats to the camera.
Yes.
That's Fleabag before Fleabag was born.
It is, yeah. Fleabag was nary on the planet at that point.
Yeah.
So you are writing a couple of cheesy books. Is there anything else you're working on now, your next project?
Yeah, so my next novel is The Goddesses of Barnsley, which is about three sisters based up in Yorkshire again, in a place called Barnsley. And they are all part of a band, or at least were in a band, and 20 years on, have gone their separate ways and have to reunite for their father's funeral, and it all kicks off. So this one is more comedy, not so much romantic. There are romantic threads in there, but it's a story of sisterhood, and I'm really enjoying writing it.
Mm, so how far through that one are you?
I think I've got about 60,000 words on my hard drive at the moment.
Cool. So, well, I really like the premise for it. I love, I don't know, I had a book, You're My Kind, where two old ex-flames meet at a funeral and they haven't seen each other for 10 years, and that sort of kicks off. And I like the thing of people meeting at funerals, because I think that people often go and cover ground like weddings, but funerals are ignored great starter points for novels and stories.
Have you recently watched Four Weddings and a Funeral? Because I revisited that as well about a year ago.
I did.
Still really get fascinated by that.
Yes, we did. My niece and her fiancé were over and he'd never seen it. So we watched it all together and it was still stands up, didn't it?
Yeah. It's funny seeing Hugh Grant in that now, considering I've forgotten the recent one that he's been in with Nicole Kidman in.
Mm.
Have you seen that one?
I haven't seen that one, no.
No.
I know the one you mean. It was on Netflix, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it's one of those lockdown Netflix ones that everyone talks about.
Yes. So you were saying that you're juggling a lot of things at the moment. So when you find the time to write, where are you finding the pockets of time? And when you do, are you sort of just seeing how much you can do at once, or are you sitting down with a word count?
Yeah, I'm finding that it's less about word count and it's more about pockets of time. So I'm getting up and I'm writing between 6 and 8 in the morning. And just where my boys are plonked in front of the TV before my working day starts, and just trying to get some of the words down then, really. And then rather than giving myself a word count, it's more, I've done a chapter breakdown. Normally I don't do that. Normally I'm a pantster rather than a planner. And this time around, I've had to be a lot more structured and just thought, right, I've got to just get the nuts and bolts skeleton of this scene down, even, and then I'll pad it out later. I've started to write a lot more like that. So just the main artery of it, and then put the flesh on later.
That's how I do it. And I love this word interiority. I've never heard it before. I'm learning new things today.
And what do you call it? You know, your thoughts in your head.
Yeah, I guess internal thoughts or something. I don't know. But I'm going to start using interiority. Yeah, I like it.
It sounds quite pretentious.
I'm trying to be more pretentious in my life, so I'm going to go that way. So what is your favourite and least favourite thing about writing?
I love the freedom of just having an idea and writing it down. I drink loads of tea when I write, and I think maybe I am a bit of a loner, and I enjoy it. I really, really love as well writing and then just thinking, oh, I need to move, and going on a run and letting that writing process just percolate through your head as you're running. And then the dislike side of things, like I'm sure like you as well, you know, when you get your knickers in a knot with plot and you just cannot get out of it, and it seems like the days are going past and you're still stuck and you're thinking about it nonstop. Every time when you go to bed, it's like, oh, how do I resolve that problem? And it just feels like you're never going to resolve it. And then thoughts come to you in the most random way, in the most random times. And then you'll probably undo something that you've written and then redo it again and for work. The millionth time over.
Yeah, the life of a writer. I'm sure though, going on a run, you run, I walk, those like you say, just that meditative process of walking or running does work things out, doesn't it, quite often?
It used to be swimming for me. There's a Lido, you know, in Charlton, that mm-hmm. I think is nearer you than it is for me. Yeah. And I used to love the process of putting my head underwater and I could just think faster somehow.
Oh.
But obviously, swimming pools... things of the past at the moment, aren't they?
Absolutely, yeah. So what's the best piece of writing advice you've ever been given, Kirsty?
Somebody once told me that writer's block is not a thing and it's just mind over matter. And I think one of the best pieces of advice was to carry on writing through it. So even if you think that you're stuck and you're just not in the mood to write, to just try anyway, even if you write anything, it normally works out that you can write yourself through the process. And also, even if you think you're just going to throw away all those words, you can probably salvage something, even if it's not for the book that you're writing at the moment. It'll trigger some thought or take you somewhere and park it on your hard drive and just harvest it when you're in need of ideas.
Yep, very good advice. And have you learned anything about yourself and your writing in lockdown? This is a brand new question.
Brand new question. Wow, I think I've learnt, yes. I've learned that writing isn't just about the amount of time that you sit in front of your laptop physically writing, and that a lot of it is needing the mental space to create plot, create characters, and work things through. And being very, very short of time at the moment and not really having any mental space, I'm finding that I am more blocked when I sit down and write. So I think so much of it forms in your subconscious. Lockdown has been quite tough for that, and I've realised that it's has having the mental space to think as much as it is physically writing the words.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm reading a book called Rest at the moment, and it's talking about the power of creative rest and how you need to build it into your schedule, and that is perfectly sort of ties in with that answer.
Has it got any solutions?
It just says you need to rest, really. That's what I'm getting. It says you need to nap, sleep well, walk, and you know how all the best sort of writers, mathematicians, scientists, they all only worked like 4 or 5 hours a day and they spent the rest of the day walking.
Oh really? That's really interesting. So are you the sort of person that can power nap?
No, I'm really bad at it. I mean, my sleep goes up and down anyway, but I cannot nap at all.
No, I can't either. And I wish I could. Mm. I'd love to be one of those people that just sets my watch like for 5 minutes and then just programs himself to just have 5 minutes downtime.
Yeah, apparently Churchill had a nap every day for an hour and then had a bath, a long bath. So he took a 2-hour break at the middle of the day, even when middle of World War II.
Amazing. We should all do what Churchill did.
And he smoked a lot of cigars and drank a lot of whiskey in the bath as well. But anyway, final question. If you could be the love child of any two writers, alive or dead, who would you choose and why?
Do you know what? I absolutely love this question. And at first, when you mentioned it, I thought, does she mean my writing style? And then I think you just mean inspirational mum and dad writers, right? So I think I would have to have David Nichols. And as odd as this may seem, probably Julia Donaldson, writer of children's books.
Okay.
So you know, she wrote The Gruffalo and everything. So honestly, some of her books, they have me in tears. So I've read them to my children. There's this one particular book called Tiddler about a fish who likes to tell tall tales. And it's that gets him into trouble all the time at school, fish school. And also it's that that manages to save his life without giving you the game away. But yeah, I really, really love Julia Donaldson's writing. I think that it's a real craft and an art to get that much done in rhyming text and to have that much heart in a story. I think it's absolutely brilliant. And David Nichols, I just love everything that he writes. As soon as he writes something new, I'm out there, one of the first to buy the books. And again, I think he's got loads of heart in his stories.
Yeah, absolutely. And they are two great choices. I've not read a lot of Julia Donaldson. I've read all of David Nichols' books, so I'm with you on that one. Brilliant. Well, this has been fantastic. Where can listeners find out more about you, Kirsty?
You can find me as Kirsty Jane on Twitter. Twitter's a friend of mine. I'm also on Facebook. I'm also on Instagram, but I have to admit, I'm not that brilliant on Instagram. And I'm not a natural grammar, if I'm allowed to say that. I just can't get into the swing of taking photos of my life. My life is too boring. But yeah, I am on Instagram as well. But Twitter's probably the best way.
Brilliant. Okay, thanks so much. This has been great.
Thank you, Claire. Thank you for having me. And thank you to all your listeners.
That's the end of this Lesbian Book Clubs. This is me, Claire Lydon, signing off. If you'd like to find out any more about me or my books, just head on over to my website at www.clairelydon.co.uk, and while you're there, you can sign up for a free lesbian romance by filling in your email in the box at the top of the page. My books are also available anywhere books are published or streamed: Amazon, Kobo, Barnes & Noble, Apple, Google, Bella Books, Ilva Publishing, and direct from me on my website. Again, that's www.clairelydon.co.uk, and there's always a bargain to be had. Thank you so much to The Lesbian Lounge for hosting and producing this podcast. It's much appreciated. And join me next month when I'll be having some more hot book club action. See you then.